Hi, Bobby Halton here for Unimac. Now, Unimac knows there's no price that you can put on a life, including ours. Being proactive with our health and safety is non-negotiable. To protect us against cancer-causing carcinogens, we need more than just clean gear. You need a total solution with the best equipment, the best technology, and the best training. That's why the good folks at Unimac partnered with an NFPA-authorized independent service provider to offer certified training on NFPA 1851 standards. When it comes to keeping us safe and healthy, demand the total package. Get training details at unimac.com/safety. That's unimac.com/safety.
Taking it to the streets is all about advancing firefighter safety and operational integrity for the fire service through provocative insights and dynamic discussions dedicated to both the art and science of firefighting and the traditions of the fire service. The focus at Taking It to the Street continues to be straightforward street-level talk with intelligent, stimulating, and provocative insights and dynamic discussion with interactive dialogue and, most importantly, listener participation. Just like around the kitchen table or in the day room over a cup of coffee at 0230 after a good run. And now, the latest edition of Taking It to the Streets with your host, Christopher Nall. Welcome to this edition of Buildings on Fires, Taking It to the Streets, on your street, in your city, across the country, and around the world. Taking It to the Streets is a monthly radio talk show on fireengineering.com, blog talk radio, and I'm your host, Christopher Naum. We've got another outstanding program planned for you without exception with what you, our listeners, have come to recognize and expect. Our conversation on this episode is focusing in on some operational issues affecting mega mansions and large area residentials. And again, there's certainly been plenty of talk and discussion over many, many years when we talk about these particular building types, occupancy risks, and their related operational demands. And certainly many of our listeners, when we talk about the terminology, which has somewhat become consistent over the last 40 years, we can actually go back to the mid-1980s in terms of talking about the origination of the term, but the terminology, the advert terminology that is common to mega mansions of today, we talk about the mega mansion, certainly had its roots in the 1980s, and we'll talk a little bit more about how that came to be as such. When we talk about these particular building types, we're talking about residential structures, talking about a unique set of criteria regarding these building types and occupancies, which is very common. So when we talk about residentials as one of the most common building types that we have and occupancies that, and for many jurisdictions, forms the bread and butter operations of everything that we do consistently on a day-to-day or certainly on some type of cyclical basis. But when we take a look at that in the context of what has dramatically changed over many years, today's buildings, today's occupancies present increasing challenges that really have and truly have redefined strategic and tactical fireground operations, have really changed the rules of engagement in structural fire incidences. And this is drawn out of our experiences, it's drawn out of the lessons from the fireground, just the factual nature of our built environment dramatically evolving, certainly over the last 20 years in terms of our decades here in the 2000s, but certainly when we take a look at the issues affecting us in the 80s and 90s and where this type of building structure originated, how it originated, and what it has evolved into today on such a dramatic standpoint, truly has given us pause. For many of you listening in and have had experience dealing with large area residentials or the mega mansions, as we are referring to them you know firsthand the struggles, the demands, the operational challenges. It certainly is not typical of our residential firefighting, the operational challenges, the construction, and as well as the life safety issues that certainly are affecting the public, first and foremost, and the life safety risks that ultimately play out and influence what we do and how we do that on the fire ground. On this episode, again, we've got a limited window of opportunity for many of you that may be listening in live or are listening to the program as a download. For those of you that are listening live, we are live right now in our program. We encourage any of you that are interested in calling in. Our number is 760-454-8852. Again, area code 760-454-8852. I would encourage any of our listeners who have some questions or want to talk about some similar challenges that they may have had in these structures. It'll allow us to get into some unscripted dialogue and discussion. I truly would like to make this a conversation. One of the reasons I chose to present the program at this particular stage. So on this particular date, if you're listening live, this is April 15th, and we're coming up within the next few hours here on an anniversary of a pinnacle event in the fire service for a variety of reasons. And that event, which led to a line-of-duty death, was the Prince Williams County, Virginia Fire and Rescue Department's line-of-duty death of a firefighter technician, Kyle Wilson. And that occurred on April 16th of 2007, and it is referred to as the Marsh Overlook Fire that occurred. There are two very explicit and specific reports that I will make reference to, and again, I would encourage our listeners, and we're going to make reference to a number of these reports as we go through our program. There are significant reports and lessons and learnings that come from the fire ground, whether they be NIOSH reports, after action report, significant event reports, safety review board reports. There are a number of these reports that if you have any type of mega mansions or large area residentials, and again, we will define those a little bit further here as we get into our program, if you have any of these larger square foot footprinted homes in your jurisdictions, and you have responsibilities to respond and operate at them, whether they be in your primary response areas, within your greater regional area, or as a mutual aid, greater alarm assignment, you need to have a higher level of knowledge, a higher level of appreciation of not only their risks, the changes and the operational demands associated with them. And again, I'll make reference to that. But the Prince Williams report was pinnacle in 2007, shortly after the event occurred. And for any of our listeners that recall that event and lived through the publication of information as it was coming out, both the initial findings, actually the initial event itself, and then the subsequent initial findings, it was very telling on a variety of levels, both from an operational standpoint as well as the emerging insights that we were getting at that time regarding two factors: fire behavior within our structures, as well as the effects of environmental impact or environmental assault. And that environmental assault primarily was the issues dealing with wind-driven conditions. Wind-driven conditions within the compartment, within the envelope, and the areas of that structure, combined with the additional influences and the characteristics associated with the building's materials, fire loading, and the subsequent fire propagation, the manner in which fire traveled within the structure, within the interior confines of the compartment, the voided spaces, as well as exterior fire spread, all were contributors that led to this perfect storm that unfortunately resulted in firefighter Kyle Wilson's death during the conduct of operations. Kyle Wilson became a firefighter because that's all he wanted to do. He died in the line of duty on Monday, April 16th of 2007, while performing a primary search within this residential structure, assuming that at 6 o'clock in the morning, in which the alarm was subsequently called out on and the department responded to, they felt and they assumed that with no one meeting them at street side, with vehicles in the driveway at that time of day, that coupled with the degree of fire that was observed from the front division, the alpha or number one division of that structure, without conducting a 360, they could see that there was extensive fire development due to the glow in the rear of the structure, and they immediately went into a mode of rescue, primary search of that structure. At that time, Kyle Wilson was just 24 years of age. So again, the timeliness of that anniversary was 14 years ago, coupled with what we typically post on our social media platforms on those anniversary dates with lessons and learnings from the fire ground, it was certainly very appropriate to talk to the degree of some of these issues affecting large area residentials, mega mansions, and try to connect some dots, try to provide some understanding to our commanders and company officers, as well as our firefighters that are listening, of what it really truly means when we talk about these structures. And again, one of the challenges is that if we can define them, if we can categorize these structures, we can then be able to develop and implement and identify a variety of different tactical perspectives, risk profiling, and what it is that we need to do at the local level based upon our resources, based upon our operational profiling, our organizational structures, based upon the knowledge, skills, and abilities of our responding units. There are a variety of options available to us. And it is not prescriptive. It certainly is a very robust, adaptive approach, especially with these buildings, based upon the footprint, based upon construction, based upon the materials. And we'll try to lead you through that process. One of the objectives here before we close out our program will be to provide you with some original insights on some large area residential events. We've actually conducted research into these fires going back a few years, since the availability of raw data is limiting based upon various types of reporting. We have built a resource and research component here that was actually part of our national training program. So we have been delivering lecture programs and seminars nationally going on about 8 years now. We were the first here in North America to originate programs on mega mansions and large area residentials, and certainly based upon the very robust degree of insights, both from the construction, engineering, and architectural standpoint, the original research and insights on adaptive fireground management principles, as well as the modeling. Our unique program really has put together a unique set of parameters to really provide the level of insights for commanders, company officers, supervisors, and department leadership to get a much better grasp of the risks and identify optimum operational capabilities to handle these incidences. So first and foremost, again, let's talk a little bit about some of the history of the lessons and learnings. And again, we will post some of these links on our social media pages commencing on April 16th, which would be tomorrow, especially in light of the anniversary of firefighter Kyle Wilson's loss of life on the job, in the line of duty, during the conduct of operations at the Marsh Overlook Fire in Woodbridge, Virginia, that occurred in 2007. So we'll provide some information on that. We'll have a link to the NIOSH report for those of you that, again, are listening. The NIOSH report number is F2007-12. There's specifically, and as is with a number of other of the reports that we are going to reference in incidences, there's not only the NIOSH reports, but sometimes in the absence of a NIOSH report where we've had a near-miss condition, of which we're going to make reference to a couple of them here on our episode, the other report that I would very much encourage you to access through the Prince Williams County Fire and Rescue's website to actually download the departmental report, the departmental investigation report. So Prince Williams County Department of Fire and Rescue initiate a very comprehensive, and at the time it was one of the most, and continues to be one of the most original and comprehensive reports, investigative reports, in the line of duty that supplements the NIOSH report in dealing with the depth and degree of looking at not only potential apparent or common causes, but actually looking at root causes, and more importantly, truly identifying corrective actions. And the results of those, of that investigation, were recommendations and corrective actions that were implemented. And that was only as a result of the strong relationship and the working relationship, actually, between government and the fire department. Without that cooperative effort between the two related entities of the municipality's political oversight, the governmental agency of Prince William's County, along with the leadership of the fire department, they were able to identify gaps, identify areas for improvements, build upon things that they were doing well, but more importantly, based upon the gaps and issues that came out of that report, they were able to move forward very expeditiously, very conclusively and inclusively into a variety of areas that truly honored the sacrifice that Kyle Wilson gave for his community and for his department. Because again, when we do have these occurrences, if we identify these gaps, identify problematic areas, or continue to help strengthen those things that we're doing well, if we're not making the appropriate improvements, then we certainly are not honoring the loss of life, that sacrifice, as well as trying to reduce the risk for other similar occurrences that might occur in the future within that organization. So Prince William's County, the department and the county work cooperatively to put the necessary mechanisms in place to make the corrective actions and the changes. I would indicate this, because we'll talk about this throughout the program. This building was, Prince Williams was built in 1992. It did have what we will commonly refer to as lightweight engineering construction. More appropriately for our listeners, you know that I like to talk about lightweight construction with a different term that we consistently try to emphasize, and that's engineered structural systems, because it is a system and component-based type of assembly that goes into the buildings. 6,100 square feet, finished walkout basement, non-sprinklered, but again, with a variety of different types of wood and material configurations, and certainly a variety of different configurations of voids that were present in that building. The fire behavior, wind-driven conditions, ultimately a roof collapse during the conduct of initial operations led to the catastrophic events and led to the line of duty death. So we'll talk about occupancy types as they relate to residential, but understand this, and this is the primary place that term originated from, but it's not occupancy type as we should be referring to in terms of any of our buildings anymore and our types of fires that we have. If I'm looking at a particular building of a construction type and occupancy usage, there are related occupancy risks that do not necessarily specifically relate to the occupancy type. So the best way to provide an analogy to this is that at the Marsh Overlook Fire, we had a footprint of a residential building of 6,000 square feet, built in 1999 with engineered structural components. So now if I talk about a residential structure built in 1948 of a similar footprint in terms of square footages and volume, it may not be entirely the same type of footprint in terms of its placement within a lot area. It might be more consolidated and compressed. It may be more vertical than horizontal, but I could very well have a 6,000 square foot single family residential built in 1948 that is of a residential occupancy. But when I relate the two together, the occupancy built in this instance in 1992 of engineered construction, residential occupancy, 6,000 plus square feet, and the one built in the 1940s, 1948, of the similar construction, or of similar square footages, but of a different type of construction, of balloon framing construction, of a different type of compartment configuration, a different type of volume orientation within the building. They are both residential structures, both have similar volume and square footages in terms of our footprint, but the manner in which that footprint and the kinds of volumes that are present within that building, within the compartment spaces, as well as the types of voids. Each one has a significant type of a void presence in there, but again, the manner in which that building will predictably perform under fire conditions is dramatically different, as well as the occupancy risk. And this is the incident, this is the event that the terminology originated when we started talking about occupancy risk versus occupancy type. And we've been talking about that consistently over the last 14 years, certainly with what we've been presenting around the country at FDIC, at our various venues and conferences and seminars that we have participated in. It's not occupancy type, it's occupancy risk. And again, the Prince Williams, Kyle Wilson line of duty death was the originating event. The other event that I want to make reference to right up front here is the Howard County Fire and Rescue Department from Howard County, Maryland, and that was the Woodscape Drive fire that occurred in July 23rd of 2018, which led to the line of duty death of Lieutenant Nathan Flynn. This was a single line of duty death as a result of a floor collapse within a structure of 7,400 square feet, and again, the time from arrival to the time of collapse, we're talking about 20 minutes. So again, that typical tactical window upon our first due arrival, we go to work, we have a building of a large area residential structure, we have a basement area of over 1,000 square feet, both finished and unfinished, we have a large footprint structure of over 7,400 square feet, and obviously in this instance, we have a significant undesirable event, which tragically resulted in Lieutenant Flynn's loss of life. He was on the first due engine company upon his arrival. Again, for many of our listeners, again, Lieutenant Flynn was a very well-known instructor at FDIC. He was also a volunteer firefighter in Harford County in Maryland. He was a 13-year fire service veteran, 34 years of age, a husband, a father of three. And again, just significant when we talk about this event. So the NIOSH report is F-2018-1313. That report is currently pending. I don't have an approximation of when that report will be issued. Obviously, as a result of COVID, there are significant delays relative to reporting coming out of NIOSH. But the one report that did come out, and this was published in June of 2019, and this was the Howard County Department of Fire and Rescue Services. It was the Internal Safety Review Report, which was issued. And this report, again, comprehensive in both depth and degree and detail. That internal report covers over 776 pages of documentation of not only looking at the root cause of the event, but also looking at the root causes of other considerations and conditions that became apparent due to the investigation process that were contributors relative to either apparent causes, common causes, or additional root causes. So they took a look at, as they did with the Prince Williams report, took a look at the entire department as a contributor and identified, again, both strengths as well as significant areas for improvement, both gaps, weaknesses, as well as some strengths, and took appropriate actions to move forward. So again, I cannot stress enough, for those of you that are in command and company officer capacities or responsibility, this is a significant report that you need to read. You need to be literate and conversant in this report, and then utilize that to retrospectively look at how that relates to you as well as your organization. So two very specific reports, Howard County, Maryland, from the June 23rd, 2018 fire, Woodscape Drive. And again, if you go to Howard County, Maryland Fire and Rescue, you can download the departmental report, the Internal Safety Review Board report, comprehensive, and again, it's required reading. I can't say it any better than that. And again, if you have not ever heard about the Kyle Wilson report, again, I would highly recommend that this is required reading as well. If you go to the Prince Williams County website, you'll find the report as well as other supplemental reference and research material that support the report findings. Again, honor both Lieutenant Flynn and Firefighter Wilson by reading, looking at the lessons, and identifying what it is that you can utilize that information for and with. Alrighty. So, and again, we'll talk about a few other reports here. We've got a number of reports that should be on your radar screen. For those of you that would actually like a download of these reports and the linkages, we do have a independent PDF. Just feel free. You can go back in, send me a message via email. We're on, again, a variety of different social media sites. Our Buildings on Fire on Facebook, our Twitter account at Command Safety, Buildings on Fire on our website, firegroundleadership.com on the fire engineering blog system, as well as the information that you'll find, again, in those varied sources. Please feel free to direct message me, text me, or contact me via email, and we'll get some of that information out, as well as other information. So much of what we're going to be presenting within our time frame is limiting. It's part of a comprehensive full day or double or two-day program that we do as part of our lecture series that we do nationally on firefighting operations in mega mansions, large area residentials. And for some of you, you've seen our shorter version of these programs at some of the conferences, including FDIC. So if you're looking for additional supplemental information, again, feel free to contact me directly, and we'll get that information out in front of you. So we talked about the changing issues. All right, before I go further, let me just, again, call-ins, guest call-ins, if you're listening in, you want to get involved in the conversation, 760-454-8852. So I encourage you to give a call in and have a chat with us on our conversation. So I'm going to somewhat jump around a little bit here. Obviously, when we talk about this in a face-to-face type setting, we utilize a very robust and rich degree of visuals and other supportive media and information. But I do want to talk about some high points when we talk about these particular building types and occupancy types. When we talk about mega mansions, as I'm going to refer to them, in large area residential structures, there are significant challenges both from construction, risks, operations, and tactics. These are not, and I cannot stress this enough, they are not your typical type of residential structure. And if you're utilizing conventional tactics and in a conventional approach toward these buildings, the operational challenges will very much and very likely overwhelm your operations. You may be lucky, you may be not lucky a few times over, but again, these types of structures really have a mission-critical standpoint of implementing aggressive tactical engagement that's tempered by tactical patience, disciplined, and managed with command resiliency. Doing our jobs, serving the public, without killing or maiming our personnel. And that only comes from and with a high degree of what we call conservative bias, which is mission-critical, critical thinking, significant, strong discipline, and decisiveness, and getting away from what we call first-do intoxication and that residential fire syndrome. So what do I mean about first-do intoxication? Well, again, how many of you have arrived on a first-do at any type of job? And you get it, right? You get that overwhelming feeling of urgency. There may be calm because it's just another job we're going to work, but there is a degree of intoxication, and I use that word in a liberal standpoint because we very well may become, or we may have a newly minted officer or a commander, or the fact that we've been, you know, running dry for a period of time, and now we've got some work in front of us, that we may feel overwhelmed, and we may suddenly lose our sense of context of situational awareness, and we end up putting the blinders on and just literally moving forward, stretching the line, going in without doing the other necessary elements that are so important on the fire ground. Now, and again, doing things without the loss of efficiency and decisiveness, but again, if we just think about what intoxication means and the first due intoxication of a rapidly evolving incident, condition, fire smoke showing, and other various types of priorities that may come about as a result of that event, that all are subject to stressors that may play on our level of discipline and play on the manner in which we conduct ourselves, both in terms of decisiveness, critical thinking, conservative bias, and going to work. So We talk about large area residentials. The issues, again, is primarily relate a couple of things. The presence of engineered structural systems, for better words, lightweight engineered construction. But again, I would encourage you not to utilize that term. That term does not accurately represent the manner in which the combination of assemblies and systems and materials and workmanship go into our current buildings and how they relate back to, especially when we talk about mega mansions and large area residentials, how they become significantly a major component when we talk about the structural system of the building, structural integrity, performance issues, and ultimately performance issues under fire duress, and how that relates back to our tactical windows. There's a lot of moving parts here, guys, but again, it's all part of that. So we talk about the presence of engineered structural systems or the presence of hybrid systems with both conventional and engineered structural systems, as well as hybrids that utilize a variety of other materials. So just recognize this. As the increase in size, both in terms of the square footages, the footprint, and the volume of the structure, as the complexity and the size increases, so does the introduction of other hybrid materials that go into the building. In other words, you may find parts of that structure, if we're talking about a 25 or 30,000 square foot residential, that have a combination of engineered structural components that provide structural support systems to floor areas, both vertical or horizontal, for floors and walls, for the various types of roof and assembly systems, but you very well may find a combination of other structural material, certainly the presence of structural steel components or a combination of light gauge steel construction, light gauge metals of non-combustible construction, coupled with, again, structural steel, coupled with engineered structural systems and other components. Again, the other components may be inclusive of concrete construction, gypcrete construction, precast members. I'll tell you right now, don't be surprised that at some point in the near future, you very well may see CLT, cross-laminated timber, being utilized within residential structures of a larger size and square footages. So there are a lot of evolving things in these buildings, and it all relates back to their classification of square footage and the complexity of their construction. The increasing or decreasing size relative to square footages and volume, materials and workmanship. There is a varying nature and degree of both types of materials that are introduced, as I just talked about, as well as the expected type of workmanship. Back in the day, when we talked about mansions, and mansions back in the day, whether you talk about them in the 30s and 40s or the 1950s and going forward, mansions were all about a level of quality and construction as well as size, which went well beyond the typical Cape Cod or bungalow, where at a time in which we had residential occupancies of 900 or 1,000 square feet, as we got into the 70s and 80s, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 square feet became the norm. Again, mansions were those buildings of 3, 4, 5, upwards of 6 or more thousands of square feet. So the expectation was that you would find solid doors, you would find solid wood doors, you would find a variety of other exotic or high-quality material that was present within that building. So although we have very large square footage buildings, both in terms of the footprint and volume, it may not be indicative of quality of workmanship or quality of material. Just think about the aspect of what looks to be real and is actually not. It looks to be a solid oak door when in fact it is nothing more than a fiberglass laminated door that has very little resiliency or resistance and certainly is not going to give you a lot of time in terms of fire control from one compartment to the other. It may be one, it may be the other, and that, again, it's important for us to recognize or at least have a degree of appreciation when we're operating in these structures, whether we do vent enter and search or vent enter isolate and search, whether we typically may encounter a non-traditional entry point for our operations, where the front door and access to the front door, the distance from that interior lobby area to the residential living quarters of the wings of the bedrooms, whether it be horizontal or vertical. Again, it's going to result in quite a bit of air consumption and time duration of or loss of time relative to ground movement. Again, many times when we take a look at both our linear horizontal base structures as well as our vertical rising mega mansions, sometimes the best point of entry very well may be from a point exterior to the structure through one of the perimeter wall areas to gain access to one of the interior rooms and then move forward with our operational and tactics from that standpoint. The increasing size and square footages also results in increasing spans. Those increasing structural spans result in stability issues affecting various areas of that structure under fire duress, whether it be through heat impingement or flame impingement or the effects of burn through or the effects of thermal assault on structural elements. So again, as we increase the span with unsupported areas and we have this larger degree of openness to the structures relative to their layout and configurations, those increasing spans based upon square footages and sizes also results in a higher degree of susceptibility and risk to the buildings in terms of us operating above, on, or underneath some of those structural areas. The susceptibility to fire dynamics, the manner in which fire will travel, both within the compartments, especially when we deal with open types of non-compartmentized floor plans within the buildings, as well as the other most critical element when we talk about the voids within the structures. And again, mega mansions, large area residentials, just in terms of their aesthetics and architectural designs, have significant numbers of interior voids that will get the best of any type of an aggressive operating series of companies on the fire ground. Unless you, again, can get ahead of it, unless you have the capability of utilizing effective thermal imaging camera techniques and operations and methodologies and practices in combination with manually opening up well in advance of where the fire is traveling to be able to proactively get ahead of conditions, you may be very well always trying to play catch-up and you will not win. The building, again, will result in a degree of fire involvement that very well may stress your operational capacity to operate within the interior confines, especially interior confines that have structural stability. So it's not the fact that the fire is kicking your butt and knocking you back out of the streets. It's the fact that the building stability based upon fire exposure within the compartment or the voids is resulting in degraded conditions that just will not allow you to continue with the conduct of those interior operations. So, again, just recognize that for the facts that they are. So we talked about susceptibility of fire dynamics. It's also the occupancy loads. You very well may find a 20 or 30 or 40,000 or higher square foot building, residential, mega mansions, large area residentials, that has only two occupants and some various types of dogs or other animals that may be present. Or you may find not only the primary families, but extended families that may be living within that structure. So it can go both ways. And going a variety of those ways, typically with the nucleus of a primary unit of a husband and wife or a significant other, whatever composition or relationship they may have, but some number of adults and some number of children's or younger adults or older adults that may be present or extended family. Again, you can certainly expect to find, you know, upwards of 8 to 10 or as few as 1 or 2 individuals along with their pets that may be present. So occupancy load factors, both their presence and locations and how that, again, is going to influence tactical windows of operations as well as deployment priorities. So the conventional rules of engagement when we talk about these structures does not typically follow the kinds of things that we normally employ on our smaller square foot residential structures. So anything less than around 4,000 square feet, again, we're trying to categorize these things It's not always hard and fast, but once you start getting into the 5,000 plus, there are a much more adaptive rules of engagement, adaptive fire ground management, and adaptive tactics that have to be identified through size up, building risk profiling, reading the building, understanding the fire dynamics, the conditions that you are encountering at that point in time, recognizing, identifying actual or suspected construction systems and other factors there based upon the siting and location of that building on its footprint. And again, the fire ground issues are going to be paramount when we relate that to reading the building. We'll talk a little bit more about what reads we have on the fire ground before I get too far ahead. There are time-determinant factors that are going to be, because the larger the footprint, the larger the volume, square footage, especially when we talk about the types of orientations of our buildings. Large area residentials have a series of different common configurations on lot areas. If you understand lot configurations and the manner in which the buildings are laid out, you can also identify the appropriate tactical processes that would be employed, selected and employed, and also the resulting tactical windows to initiate that tactic. It's not always going to follow what we've typically have been trained and have developed the experience levels on when we talk about these particular buildings. So there are going to be very specific tactical windows that are time-dependent factors and time-determinant regarding building integrity, compartment integrity, potential risk to civilians relative to exposure to fire products, as well as risk factors relative to the fire behavior to our firefighting companies within the structures. I've talked about this a couple times, size, the square foot, the volume, the configurations, and the layout. These are all important elements here that, again, will influence decision-making. They will influence tactical decision-making, tactical identification, and the deployment of task-level operations. They are going to be givens. If you are so foolish to think that they are not, guys, then at some point you'll get it when, again, you're caught under some challenging situations where this becomes a little bit more understanding and apparent. What we want to do is keep that from happening when you have those adverse conditions. Talked about the spans, talked about another element here is the program spaces. As the size of the footprint of that building, as we go from a residential structure of that 4,000 to 5,000 square foot plus, we start seeing what we call an increase in program spaces. We now have additional great rooms. We have other areas of the building where we now have a home theater, or you may have a variety of other ancillary bedrooms and sitting areas and libraries and the more formal dining rooms and eating areas, as well as the bowling alleys, the swimming pools, the lap pools, and a variety of other types of spaces that are common to the large area residentials and the mega mansion type structures as we move forward. So as the square footage increases, so does the number, the quantity of program spaces, the types of compartments, the spaces, both in terms of square footages, the volume sizes, and their connectivity. What is vertical in the vertical standpoint? What's horizontal? What's connected side by side? Do we have open plans? Do we have some degree of compartmentation? To what level do we have compartmentation that also provides resiliency and resistance regarding fire travel and exposure and propagation? These are all things that one has to think about. Again, I'll just make note of our call-in number, 760-454-8852 for our listeners. Anybody want to call in? We are live, and I do encourage you to call our number in, and we'll put you into our conversation. And then lastly, the other three elements is the resource demands regarding what are you sending for your first response. What are you sending for your alarm activations or your investigations? How does that play out when we talk about time demands and you're showing up with a single engine that's short-staffed and you suddenly encounter a fire within the basement or a fire within the structure, or you're sending out a short resource box of companies, a one-on-one or whatever the composition characteristics may be in terms of numbers, but you're sending anything other than a robust series of resources for that box that when needed, are going to be needed now and not within the 8 to 10 to 15 minutes of response time that may be necessary, or that might result from the time in which we identified the need, call that second alarm or call the all hands, whatever it may be, call mutual aid, and that those services end up coming. You've got to think about those fire dynamics within this compartment. They are not going to react as we typically have seen. So the fire resource demands, fire dynamics, and then lastly, the issues dealing with the lack of inherent protection systems. Very well, you may find alarm systems, both burglar as well as detection or smoke detection and alarming systems, and the likelihood of finding a proactive, robust sprinkler system within the structures is more the rule of thumb than it is the exception. So just recognize that for those of you that have robust ordinances in place that requires sprinkler protection, that's a good thing because, again, much of the issues and problems that we talk about within these structures really goes away and becomes much more manageable. Not that they go away, but they do truly become much more manageable when we talk about the operational parameters and the risk factors of occupancy risk. And we can, at some instances, utilize conventional tactics and operations and move forward from there. Certainly appropriate to say this when we talk about mega mansions and large area residentials, especially in light of my last couple of comments. When I talked about the bullet points dealing with resource demands, fire dynamics, those two in particular, you really got to start treating these buildings, residential structures, of a larger square footages, especially when you get anywhere beyond the 10 to 12 on up square footage, 1,000 square footages. You really got to start thinking of these building fire. What are you typically responding out to in the street? What's the box alarm? What is the composition of personnel and companies that respond to that higher risk structure that more often than not is protected, but yet you're sending whatever you're sending, and it can be, again, if we're talking about on the deficient side, you're sending one and one. You're sending one company. You're sending a couple of engines or some type of a water source along with a pumping capacity of a unit. Do you have truck and aerial capacities? Do you have limitations based upon where this building may be located? Again, we'll get into that also here, but whatever you're sending may not be appropriate, and sometimes is dramatically not appropriate at all for the size of that structure and the expected fire dynamics within the compartments and the life hazards and risks and the operational demands regarding the tactical windows and some of the other factors that come about when we talk about time-dependent operations and the susceptibility to fire dynamics. So these are important concepts to recognize when we put that forward. Some of you may be having some good conversations at the kitchen table regarding these. Some of you, again, when we talk about lessons and learnings, I'll just make mention of a couple more here. You know, we talked about Prince Williams. We talked about the Howard County, Maryland line of duty death of Lieutenant Flynn. But again, I'll just read off a couple of them other here that to make reference to, again, as we go through a program. Another, again, Virginia, Loudoun County, significant near miss, a roof collapse, fire behavioral conditions, May 25th of 2008, and this was referred to as the Meadowood Court Fire. Again, significant near misses, residential fire, 7 firefighter injuries, 4 serious, 3 Mayday bailouts, again, all dealing with fire behavior, fire dynamics, building construction issues, and so forth. This residential structure was built in 1999, totaling of 3,300 square feet, along with 1,500 square feet of a basement area and with a poured walkout basement. So when we take a look at total living spaces in conjunction with those elements, along with the other factors in that led to this near miss, again, you'll start connecting and seeing some commonalities. It was interesting to note that in 2007, we had the Kyle Wilson line of duty death, the Meadowood Court Fire in 2008 also identified some commonalities. And those commonalities dealt with the approved, in the Commonwealth of Virginia at the time, an approved building material that was highly susceptible, and that was the sheathing material that was underneath the exterior perimeter walls that was a contributor toward fire propagation, fire extension, because of its combustibility. So there are things here that, as we share and as we learn, there are things that sometimes are working for us and other times are working against us. I'll make reference to another large area residential fire that occurred. Actually, we posted this on our Facebook page, our Buildings on Fire on Facebook. For those of you that have followed us over the last 12 years on Facebook in particular, you'll know and recognize that we post significant linkages to anniversaries, lessons and learnings. And again, recently on March 7th was the anniversary of the Sweet Road Fire that occurred in Onondaga County. That's in the central New York, Syracuse metropolitan area of upstate New York. Double line of duty death of firefighter Timothy Lynch and the firefighter line of duty death of Lieutenant John Gino Ketty. And both firefighters lost their lives as a result of a floor collapse in a single-family residential operating in a fire within the basement and a catastrophic floor collapse of that residential flooring area, which in this instance was a parallel cord wood truss system that extended over the primary area of operation. And again, the NIOSH report in this instance is NIOSH F2002-06. So I would encourage you to take a look at that report explicitly. Significant lessons, and if you've heard us talk about that report on the road or at FDIC, lots and lots of learnings out of that report. When I talked about the other report just a moment ago, when we talked about the report in Loudoun for the near miss, that did not result in a NIOSH report, but did result in a comprehensive report that the Loudoun County Fire Department did put out. And again, if you go to Loudoun's webpage and you go to the fire department's linkages there, you will find some very useful information. The actual serious incident report, investigation report that provides some insights on the lessons and learnings, the contributors that went into that particular report. I will make mention, too, that you very well may see, if you keep track of us on, again, on Facebook or on Twitter, you will see that we are going to be offering, we just don't have the date lined up as of yet, but we will be offering a webinar program within the next couple of weeks. We're just locking down the date here. It very well may come about before the end of the month. We are trying to shoot for a possible weekend or weekday presentation. So it'll either be toward the end of this month in April or in the first week of May. So for those of you that are interested in seeing an expanded version and really getting into some of into the weeds on this with the advantageous use of or the advantage of use of some of our slides and visuals and so forth, just keep an eye out for our short version Mega Mansion Large Area Residential webinar that you'll see published here and advertised in the very near future. So a couple of those items here that, again, as we talk about these reports, but the significant injury investigation report for Meadowood Court, again, was issued in September of 2008, which makes reference to the May 25th, 2008 near-miss event. So with that being said, so when we've talked about this, we talked a little bit about the Cape Cod, the bungalow structures. So, you know, what's the big deal? What's changed dramatically? So back in the 50s, the 1950s, the average home size, the average square foot of a residential typical of a Cape Cod or bungalow was just under 1,000 square feet. The average was just around 900 square feet. And again, family sizes were significantly higher. So you had smaller buildings, but a higher number of occupancy loads. And if we relate that back to the current standpoint, if we go to the issues here with as recent, or go back to one of the referencing here, we go back to 2008, since we're talking about some of the events of 2007 and 2008, the average residential size in 2008 was 2,500 square feet. However, the family size ended up being reduced. It went from 3.8 to 2.6. So we're seeing a reduction in occupancy risks or occupancy loading, but we're also seeing an increase in volume square footages relative to the sizing of the structure, which ultimately still ends up affecting occupancy risk when we talk about the occupants of the structure. And I'll expand a little bit more here about how these sizings have changed. One of the things that we have been utilizing and leveraging, actually going on 20 years now, actually going on our 21st year, we came up with and have been promoting the concept and the model of building vintage and era of construction as a basis to support effective size up, the concept of reading the building, and more importantly, relating the ability to subjectively identify within a certain given time frame. It's not prescriptive, but it's somewhat subjective. If you can identify approximately the era and vintage, the year or decades, we have a matrix that actually categorizes our buildings relative to this time span going back from all the way actually to from the 1700s all the way to the current standpoint. We classify our buildings within these eras of vintage and the era in which they were built, and we give it a name. And many of you are familiar when we talk about modern construction and legacy construction. And I will go so far to say this unapologetically, is that we've really done the fire service a injustice by referring to those categories as being the black and white of it all. In other words, if it's not modern construction, it's legacy, and we've categorized everything under this term of legacy and handicapped us to truly understand opportunities for further insight in our buildings. We actually have a logical progression of both terms and timeframes, the span of time that relates to these buildings, and we'll sort of leave that for another point of discussion for those that are interested in seeing what our areas and vintage are, and we can constantly promote that in our live conversations and online programming, but we also do that within our podcasts and webinars and so forth, but we've been doing that and promoting it based upon our insights going back now 20-plus years. When we talk about the era of the 1900s to the 1950s, so talking about the types of structures, it's indicative of what we call both heritage and legacy construction. So there's heritage, meaning our older type structures from the late 1800s, early 1900s, our legacy construction periods, again, from the mid-1920s going forward up until about the 1960s, and then what we primarily call conventional construction is that construction that took place post-World War II up until, again, around 1980s when we started seeing the true first movement of modern construction. But if we just talk about residential construction from the 1900s to the 1950s, the common type of structure was anywhere from 1,000 to 3,500 square feet, typically of brace framing and balloon frame construction. Characteristically, again, we had buildings that had very compact types of compartments. We had compartmentation. We have a variety of construction and material that gave us a very predictable type of building construction and performance. When we moved into the conventional era, which primarily is the 1945 to about 1959, again, 1959, 1960, we started seeing the evolution of that residential house. The Cape Cods were very primary, especially in the build-outs post-World War II. The Cape Cods, the bungalows, that 800 to around 1,200 square foot single-family residential versus in some instances the multiple occupancies. As we moved forward in the 1960s up to about 1975, we really started seeing the evolution of that residential home from about 1,400 to around 2,000 square feet. And that was very common up to around 75, 76, 78. And so when we started moving into the 1980s, did we start seeing the true evolution of the movement into larger area residentials. And that was due to a variety of factors. The common residential structures built in the era of the 1980s through 2000, again, conventional construction, it is inclusive of around 1,900 to around 3,500 square feet. Around the mid-1980s, the term was coined McMansion, because what we started seeing at that time in the mid-1980s was a rapid movement within a very concise category of homes for those that had the economics and financial means. We went from a typical 2,000 square foot, again, 18, 19, 2,000 square foot common newer type of homes at that time, to the introduction of that 3,500 to around 4,000 square foot single family residential. And that was pretty significant. Again, larger homes, not built of quality. They certainly were not mansions when we talk about the quality level, but the term as it connotates came about primarily from the architectural area. There was a columnist who was a writer for a national newspaper publication, and he was their editor on architecture, and he started talking about McMansions, these cheaply built structures that had all of these types of add-ons of columns and ornate appearances, the aesthetic, non-functional types of add-ons that created a look and feel of a mansion, but without the quality, both in terms of materials and workmanship. We had size increases, so you had these mansions that were anything but non-quality conditions. So offending the fast food organization that utilizes the prefix of Mac, again, when you think of that food chain, you don't think of high-quality five-star course dinners or steak dinners and such. But again, the critic, the architectural critic at the time, started referring to these types of large area residentials, these mansions of typically 35 to 4,000 square foot, as McMansions. And that suddenly took hold within the fire service. It was a derogatory comment, and it still stays with us today. But if I talk about a McMansion today, a McMansion could be 40,000 square feet, it could be 75,000 square feet, 20, 30, 15, and yes, anything of a lower capacity. But what we have seen as we start moving forward in the 1980s and into the 2000s is we start seeing, again, residential structures. So if we move forward from, let's say, from the 1960-75 era, which we just talked about, we start moving into the 80s and into the 2000s, we now not only see increasing square footages, but we start seeing the start of the movement of larger spans. We start seeing increasing programmatic spaces. We start seeing the types of area usages, the kinds of configurations that starts affecting our oriented search. It starts affecting hose line deployment, water flow deployment in terms of gallon per minute, sustainable flows. We started seeing the introduction of various types of other tactics that were common to urban type settings being employed within the suburban type settings. Again, all of these things started culminating and coming together, as well as the introduction in the early 1980s and certainly moving through the late 90s and into the beginning of the 2000s, the emergence of engineered structural components. Lightweight construction was being introduced at that time, and everything that has given us. So again, these buildings have predictability. They are definable building performance, tactical windows of operations, time management considerations, gallon per minute flow rates, configurations, layouts, and as well as the types of materials, configurations, and workmanship. Each one of these eras and vintages and square footages, definable tactics, risk, operational profiles, the kinds of things that one has to be familiar with and then to utilize during our size up and then deploy accordingly during the conduct of our operations. Between the period and the era of the 2000s to the 2015 timeframe, again, a significant, robust growth. We started seeing the common 3 to 8,000 square foot residential footprints and everything that they give us in terms of programmatic spaces, zero lot configurations. So compact configurations in many jurisdictions where you literally have a building that's on that zero lot line and sometimes less than 10 feet distance between one perimeter wall and the other. So that lends into itself a whole series of exposure, communication issues, conflagration, fires going from primary areas of origination where we have the primary structure, and more often than not, the multiple exposure extensions occurring on either divisions of that structure, as well as the trend of increasing common spaces that are interconnected. Connectivity that's both horizontal of spaces, the movement of open kitchen areas to great rooms and the sitting areas and so forth, as well as the increasing square footages and sizes, and the movement toward non-compartmentation. The mega mansions, again, we start looking at the residentials of the 2000s, 2010, the evolutions of that 7 to 10,000 square foot, high reliance on engineered structural systems that are going to be present within that buildings, and then again, the categorization of some of our structures in that 10 to 40,000 square foot, high reliance on engineering principles, a variety of hybrid constructions, and truly gave us the development of our mega mansion types of structures. Let's take a quick break here. I'm going to queue up a quick little commercial here. I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll come right back in, talk about some specifics on categorization of our structures. You're listening to Buildings on Fire, Taking to the Streets. I'm your host, Christopher Naum, and we are talking about some operational insights on mega mansions and large area residentials. We'll be right back.
Looking for timely information and insights to support today's fire service demands? FiregroundLeadership.com provides outstanding e-media offerings across a broad range of topics that include lessons from the fireground, building construction and fire dynamics, adaptive fireground management, tactical discipline, and much more. FiregroundLeadership.com, operational excellence on today's evolving fireground. A buildingsonfire.com series, now on Penwell's Fire EMS blog, a part of the fireengineering.com, Firefighter Nation, Fire Rescue Magazine, e-media services. TheFireOfficer.com is highly regarded and recognized as the premier e-media site for information and insights for leadership, knowledge, and training for today's fire service. Focusing on the emerging and practicing fire officer and field commander, TheFireOfficer.com is dedicated to providing in-depth insights on leadership, operation, the modern fireground, and professional development with over 22 additional fields of dedicated e-media support. TheFireOfficer.com, a BuildingsOnFire.com series now on Penwell's Fire EMS blog, a part of the FireEngineering.com, Firefighter Nation, and Fire Rescue Magazine e-media services.
Welcome back to this edition of Buildings on Fires, Taking to the Streets. I'm your host, Chris Naum. We're talking about some operational insights and trying to have a conversation on some of the issues affecting mega mansions, large area residentials. Talk about a variety of different things over the last segment here on our program. Again, I would encourage our listeners, I'm seeing some good, robust conversations occurring on social media. We know that there's some listeners out there. We encourage you to quickly jump on if you'd like to talk a little bit about some items here. Again, our guest call-in is 760-454-8852. We get into our second half of our program here, and again, I'll touch upon some key insights. I know that our time allotment is moving quickly forward here. Again, we've gone into our first hour of our segment. We could easily make this a two- or three-part series for those of you that are listening in. Again, you may be doing so in snippets of time, but again, our part two segment here will continue some of that discussion point. I'll go back into a couple of referencing here to some McMansion mansions, large area residential mega mansions reports here. As we've done in our first half, we made reference to a number of incidences that are quickly here on anniversaries that are either coming forward or have just recently passed. Some other items that, again, are explicitly part of your required reading. It includes a couple of other items. We've talked about a couple of events in Virginia. We've talked about Maryland. We've talked about an event in upstate New York in the Syracuse metropolitan area. I'll make reference to another report that, again, is required reading. Coleraine Township, Ohio, April 8th, 2008. The significant line-of-duty death, double line-of-duty death, as a result of a floor collapse, single-family residential. 16 minutes to May Day, from the time of response to the time in which the May Day occurred in a 1991 vintage single-family residential. The loss of life of Captain Robin Brockstrom and Firefighter Brian Shearer as a result of that event. Again, NIOSH report F-2008-09, as well as the other significant report that was completed internally in terms of the investigative analysis by the Coleraine Township Department of Fire and Emergency Medical Services, and that's referred to as the investigative analysis of the Squirrel's Nest Lane firefighter line of duty death of April 4th of 2008. That report, the departmental report, similar to what we talked about with both the Prince Williams report, the Howard County report, the investigative report by that department, again, was in-depth, in detail, comprehensive both in scope and in terms of the identifiers and the lessons and learning. So 468-page report that should be required reading for any of you that have never, number one, are not familiar with the events and the report and the conditions that led to the double line of duty deaths. Again, we have some information that we've posted online on our Facebook page. That our anniversary just recently passed, so I want to encourage you to take a look at those particulars. And we'll talk about some commonalities of these incidences toward the end of our second part series here on this episode, based upon just some high-level insights on some original research that we've done that's part of our seminar series that actually forms the basis of some of our recommendations on tactics and operations and building predictability as such. Another report that, again, was a near miss, it does not have a NIOSH report, but it does have a departmental report. This occurred in Calvert County, Maryland, a significant injury investigation report. It's referred to as the Soper Road Report that was published by the Huntingtown Volunteer Fire Department and Rescue Squad Significant Event Report. The Soper Road Report was issued in 2012, referring to an event that occurred on March 19th, 2011. 10,000 square foot mega mansion, and again, 15 minutes of interior operations that as a result of very dramatic wind-induced fire conditions, fire dynamics within the structures, combined with, again, inherent building configurations and conditions within the attic and within the voided spaces resulted in very rapid changing conditions and forced the emergency evacuation under untenable conditions on the floor of 10 first responders. 10 were injured, 4 received very significant burn injuries. Again, a significant near-miss event report. If you've never heard of that event report, again, another one to add to your list. And as I mentioned in the first part of our series, for those of you that are interested in our downloadable reference here of these reports, things that should be on your reading list, just feel free to direct message me, get my email, text me, what have you, based upon our information that's online, and I'll make certain we get you that information. All right, a couple of other things here as we move forward, and again, I'll try to stay on track here of some high point items here. We talked about challenges. We talked about some of the demands, tactical limitations, the fire dynamics, compartmentational issues, vulnerability regarding heat and exposure, susceptibility of the compartments. One of the things that we made mention early on was some of the challenges both in terms of size, volume, the number of programmed spaces within the building. It also is inclusive as the square footages of these buildings increase. as the size and volume and the type of footprint configuration increases, as does the complexity of construction. That complexity of construction, coupled with the methods and materials of construction, coupled with increasing structural spans, creates a level of risk within the structure that directly influences tactical decision-making, tactical deployment, tactical windows of operations. In other words, how much time do you have to conduct task-level operations, and also creates a susceptibility of compromise and collapse potential to either isolated or associated areas within the structure. In other words, it very well may not be a limiting, isolated, compromising condition. You very well may encounter a catastrophic, large area collapse due to the assemblies and systems and the configurations, the methods and the materials and the spans that occur within these particular structures. So this lack of compartmentation coupled with the connectivity of our program spaces coupled with fire dynamics actually influences and creates tactical limitations and tactical windows of opportunity. These all create a threat to civilians regarding life safety. In other words, they now become highly vulnerable to the effects of fire within that interior confines of the building, and that in turn very well may create varied levels of risk that we just need to be appreciative of and understand while we conduct our operations. Sometimes those influencers or stressors will clearly determine what type of tactic is deployed and employed by companies, depending upon the kinds of locations of our buildings, which I need to talk about here very quickly, because again, the locations of these building types, coupled with the characteristics of these buildings, also influence the type of an adaptive fire ground management model and deployment that one selects. In other words, guys, it's just like I said from the get-go. It's not a typical residential structure. It's not going to be your typical tactics. It's going to be much more in common with a commercial building, with its complexities, its gallon per minute fire flows, its tactical windows. The only critical thing here that is missing is that we don't have resiliency, integrity, which gives us operational time that, and protection relative to protective systems that one would find in a large square foot commercial building. We're not going to find them in the similar square footage or larger residential building, but yet we're going to be considering and handling that like we would a three-bedroom, 15 or 2,000 square foot residential more commonly. And I've seen it time and time again. I've gotten into the discussions with the guys is that we still just stretch the line and go in expecting similar results of being able to control these conditions within tactical windows that continue to become more and more compressed. So again, that leads us into this conversation, just quickly talking about conditioned tactical reflexes that are developed by the types of common residential structures that you are encountering in your primary response areas or again, within your jurisdictions. What kind of buildings do you typically respond to, and what kind of results, tactics, and conditions do you have? How risky are they? How do the buildings perform? What are the tactical windows of operation? Are they unlimited? In other words, we put the fire out before bad things end up happening, or do we have to be very cognizant of a tactical window that more often than not is a 10-minute duration of time, a tactical window that has to be recognized, comprehended, understood, and respected when we talk about fire ground operations. It results back into considerations of resource staffing, command, the conventional types of tactics, our operations and time, and the outcomes, our rules of engagement. When we take a look at the evolving nature of our larger square foot residentials, occupancy risks start increasing, and we see the same resulting issues. It's going to be a whole different perspective that changes resources, staffing, command, tactics, operation, time, and certainly the rules of engagement end up changing more toward an adaptive fire ground management principle. We underestimate or disengage or disregard fire behavior on the structure. We don't have an appreciation for the complexity of the structure. compartment stability, the need for immediacy of actions, the need for effectiveness of those actions, continuous fluid assessment and monitoring of both the building, the compartment, and our companies. It goes back into what I'll mention here in a moment about the building reads. So we've got to be monitoring building, compartment, and company. We have to understand the impacts on our occupants, have an appreciation of predictability of building performance, which leads us into a whole conversation, discussion about building construction, and again, related back to classifications, the era, as well as size factors. That's part of our adaptive fireground model when we get into tactics and operations. And then lastly, talking about time, task, intervention, and control. These are all critical concepts. So the mission critical degrees of engagement, when we refer back to adaptive fireground management, is again the immediacy and robust resources, the effectiveness and proficiency of our staffing, goes back to that company component, concurrent tactical engagement. You've got to be able to deploy multiple concurrent tactical deployments because of the immediacy of what needs to be done and the robustness of resources. So if I am responding with an inadequate amount of resources on a 25,000 square foot residential that has command of a sizable square footage of area based upon the fire loading package within that structure, you very well may not have sustainability of a gallon per minute flow rate. You may not have the adequacy of resources. It's going to be, well, I'm either going to start attacking the fire, I'm going to initiate a primary search, I'm going to initiate rescue out of the structure. I mean, what is it that you're going to do? And again, if we are giving up one versus the other, there has to be some other course of action that's going to make up for it, or that has to be considered. I'll tell you this, again, in some instances, based on square footages, based upon time of event, based upon the immediacy of robust resources and the proficiency and capabilities and the demands of prioritized incident conditions. In other words, if we're in a life safety mode, civilian search, civilian extrication, removal, and rescue, the primary mission of that engine company with either sustainable or limited water source capabilities may be to provide protection to support the rescue modes. We're not going to go into any kind of rescue suppression capabilities because we just don't have the gallon per minute flow rate, nor do we have the staffing levels. But the critical part here is to provide support for the rescue mission, to provide a reduced level of risk and a very high risk evolution that requires and demands a level of protection. So again, those are the kinds of options that commanders need to recognize. Company officers, again, you show up on scene. Again, you need to be thinking about these options that more often than not fall out of our conventional tactical theories, practices, and modeling, and our tactical types of conditioning that we typically practice and employ. So again, you've got to consider the concurrent tactical engagement. You also have to consider tactical mobility. And that now gets into the aspects of how can I move through that structure vertically or horizontally. Air management considerations. I'm moving into a structure that does not have recognizable orientation spaces. I can't go through and do any type of oriented search patterns within the building. We now have to consider, again, I might have to have an anchor point in a lobby control or some control in a hallway location, go off of some type of a tethered lifeline just to ensure I have the ability to orient myself into the various compartments because of size, configuration, square footages, and volumes, and the precarious aspects of fire dynamics to be able to move into these compartments and move back out of them and get to my point of safe refuge to get out of that building. So again, that tactical mobility, both in terms of movement through the structure as well as tactical mobility regarding the movement of our hose lines. Think about this, and again, here's part of that other read. It's the ability to read the fire ground in terms of how is that building, which very well may have a sizable footprint of a various types of topical terrain with various types of vegetation. I may have types of elevation changes between the front of vision on the alpha number one side to the rear of the structure, even moving around the building in terms of different types of landscape and terrain conditions, weather conditions, and so forth, all of which create a type of entry point in which, again, if we're entering through the primary entry door, leads us into a lobby, you may be significant feet away from the compartment areas in which the residential bedrooms may be located, or just getting to other areas within a 20 or 30 or 40,000 square foot residential, which now requires what? It requires a different tactical approach, which is more associated with large area commercial type firefighting, whether it be the deployment of prepackaged hose lines and a variety of other things that we just don't have the ability to get into that level of detail. But our operational tactical profile may be entirely different. So tactical mobility, the movability of our resources company and equipment into that building to initiate concurrent tactical engagement, which all relates back to time management in terms of air supply, time management regarding physical exertion, time management as it relates to the fire dynamics. These are all concurrent. So as we move into these tactical windows, we've got to be considering a tactical window of approximately 10 minutes from time of arrival, not time of dispatch, but time of arrival, 10-minute window of monitoring those conditions, and then determining what additional courses of actions we are going to undertake. But the worst things that end up happening relative to fire dynamics, building susceptibility, integrity factors will present themselves around that 10-minute window. And again, we can get into some robust conversations on that. We really should do a free online webinar just talking about tactical windows for about an hour or so. I think, again, for some of you that are trying to put this together and trying to follow it, for many of you that have listened to me talk about this in the past, you clearly understand and connect that dot to it. But time management is a critical mega mansions, large area residentials, which leads to an adaptive fire ground management modeling profile considerations. And again, the other critical part here, guys, is this. You got to do the work up front. Pre-fire incident building intel. You got to look at your first dues, your mutual aid response area. These buildings are out there. If you're not recognizing pre-fire planning them, if you are not spending and investing the time to either ask for permission while they're under construction or access the sites during off hours and truly watch the construction phases and get a level of appreciation. There are no books out there that cover these things. And again, we've been diligently trying to put together some resources to expand upon construction methods and materials, put these together out into some short white papers. We've actually worked through our COVID timeframe, putting together some pretty good documentation, but we're still a ways out to be able to publish that information out to help support the efforts that are needed. Yeah, the best place to be, again, when we talk about even our training classes, we do a lot of our building construction classes in combination with both classroom and field delivery. Good friend of mine, Battalion Chief Danny Sheridan out of FDNY, we did a program in late 2019, walking tour, talking about building construction in the streets of New York City, a full-day program where we went from Midtown Manhattan all the way down to Ground Zero, talking about construction, looking at building features, and many of my programs that we have been doing in small venues around the country, again, on our building construction series, is all about taking the classroom into the street, again, taking it to the streets literally, where we do our classroom presentations on building construction, then go out in the streets, walk the streets down, looking at the buildings. That is the only thing. So, I'm really demanding of you to get your companies out into the construction sites to look at these buildings to gain that knowledge and appreciation, or if nothing else, to be able to ask the questions. Take a look at what's going on, ask the questions, bring that information back to command company officers, and identify, research out, call the authoritative individuals that are out there. There are many of us that are moving forward with the whole concepts of construction and fire ground operations and doing much of which was laid out back in the 70s and 80s by a lot of great individuals that have long passed, but we still are not spending anywhere near enough time talking about and learning about building construction. So I talked about the building read, so let me move really quickly forward. It's reading the fire ground because of the topography, the layout of these buildings will have an influence on decision-making tactical operations. So it's reading the fire ground, it's reading the building, it's reading the compartment of which you are reading smoke and reading fire behavior, but it's all about reading the compartment, building upon Reading Smoke that, again, Chief Dotson has given us. And then the fourth component is Reading the Company. It's understanding and looking at four distinctive reads on the fireground that have an influence on the concept of adaptive fireground management. I've talked a couple of times about the aspects of the classification of our buildings. One of the things that many years ago when we first started talking about large area residential, and again, back in the day, the conversation always revolved around just talking about McMansions, right? It was everything to do about these McMansions. Well, first and foremost, it was interpreted, and we still utilize that terminology today, which again, if I talk about a McMansion today in 2021, it could be anything from a 4,000 square foot to 40,000 square foot residential. And again, the span of size and volume and complexity, when I go back to the issues of size, volume, program, spaces, complexity of construction, span, susceptibility of compromise and collapse, the vulnerability of fire conditions, the compromising aspects of the conditions within the building, they are all going to be very distinctively different within certain construction spans in terms of square footages and so forth. So before I talk about the classification, let me also make reference to the type of influencing factors. So the kinds of large area residentials or mega mansions that one may have may fall into a variety of classifications. And these classifications also have models that they are associated with in terms of operational profiling, and you can understand that. So we have influencing factors of a, again, mega mansion or large area residential, if they are within the urban or metro environment, if they are in the urbanized suburban environment, if they are in suburbia, if they are in the outer ring suburban type of context, the rural countryside context, the rural wildland interface, the wildlands, which is actually what we call MONW, the middle of nowhere. So some of you, or again, in some areas of the country, we have significant, sizable, large area residentials that are literally in the middle of nowhere that end up requiring significant response times from the fire department to their location, and the resulting impact of fire on the buildings is very predictable. If we're not showing up and it's burnt to the foundation, we have some degree of building integrity left. But again, what effect will that have on anyone that's trapped within that structure? But there are significant elements. When we talk about rural, suburban, or wildland issues, the other two classifications include mountain, and then lastly, coastal, seaside, or waterfront. Waterfront primarily associating with lake or river. So when we talk about these categories, they are influencers. So our first element would be to classify them relative to any one of these influencing factors. And each one of these has subsets associated with them. If we talk about coastal and seaside areas, again, just quickly, I'll just say that there's accessibility conditions. You have the fireground side versus the seaside. There are design, anatomy, and features. The raised pier, the soft base, the propagation of fire growth, typically regarding exposure issues. Tactical mobility, gallon per minute flow rates. I mean, just quickly, a couple of things off the top of my head. When we talk about the footprints, the vertical nature of these types of structures, exposure issues, and so forth, which is going to be dramatically different than some of our other structures. When we talk about inner city or urbanized areas, we have some of the true mansions, which, again, based upon era and vintage of construction, there are everything from compartmentized structures, or you may have a true modern type of mansion, large square footage. So vintage and era are going to be important. The resiliency and integrity in time, our concept of RIT and building performance, structural performance of the building. Response is more timely. Deployments are more timely. And again, more often than not, proven methodologies or practices and our rules of engagement will work because we are in an urban environment that reduces response times, quick, robust deployment of our operations and services and so forth. We get into, I think here, if we talk about the outer ring or our rural and countryside settings, predominantly we are dealing with single site or small clusters of these types of residential buildings, typically large plots, large acreages. We have a false positive. You know, we're close, but we're too far in terms of conditions and some of these other factors because, again, we're slightly farther away, but we're still close, and there's going to be some variables that are all going to be time-dependent. We more often than not have longer driveways, accessibility issues, are spread out more often than not. They're longer versus taller. There are very well maybe ancillary buildings that are maybe present. There may be the availability of static water sources, and again, the issues with tactical mobility as such. So the only other thing I'll say that for some of you listening are our outer ring or our rural or countryside types of setting, it's typically the highest growth areas for development because typically it gives us a predominantly greater amount of land availability. And again, as a result of this growth area in these outer locations, response times, protection coverages, special needs for fire services are going to be present, high risk, low frequency probability, a whole different issue dealing with fire protection services. And again, can we even provide baseline level of fire services? Again, we typically are not deeming these at risk because they're low frequency. We typically cannot justify against the daily demands in terms of placing a single engine out in that location or specialized equipment or resources or demanding additional static water sources. I mean, there's a whole variety of things, but again, guys, as we get into these details in some of our other programs, we really get into the nuts and bolts and into the weeds of some of those particulars. So first and foremost, if you're thinking about how to pre-plan and how to come up with tactical approaches, this is part of that connect the dots. It's part of the first formulative elements here to classify the considerations of location, and then subsequently it's going to be inclusive of categorizing them based upon their term, and that's part of what we talked about. So I mentioned about we talked about the mega mansions, we talked about large area residentials. There's a differentiation between them, the McMansions, and I'll tell you here very rapidly what the McMansion typically should be referred to. So if we have consistency in how we classify and identify our buildings, the natural course is that we can now identify the types of tactical approaches, the tactical windows, the gallon per minute flow rates that are going to be necessary or highly suggested. We could also identify suggested decision-making considerations, all of which are going to be driven by what you're going to be seeing and experiencing at a given time in the street at a given job. But you have to be pre-programming yourselves in preparation for that. Earlier on in the first part of our program, I talked about the evolution of the residential home. 1950s, typically around 980 square feet. We moved into the 1960s. The average square footage was 1,200. The 70s, it gave us around 1,400. The 80s, 1,700. The 90s, the average, again, average across the country was 2,100 square feet. Into the 2000s, up until about 2010, it averaged around 2,400 square feet. 2010, around 2,500, 2015, 26, 2018, around 29. And that was a little bit up and a little bit down. 2008, we saw that downside based upon the bubble that occurred relative to the economy and so forth. But as we've gotten into the 2000s, again, construction became very stagnant. It was approaching as an average of around 3,000. 3,100 square feet. So again, it's going to be interesting to see once we start seeing data with construction starting back up again, especially as a result now of a couple of things. A move toward upsizing in terms of individuals as a result of coming out of COVID here in the early stages of moving into upper size houses, building higher size buildings. There's also a movement back in reverse in terms of the smaller footprint type of open plan residential. So there's going to be a number of things that are going to influence our operations here. Recognize this too, that when we talk about NFPA 1710 and 1720, there's a constant reference to this 2,000 square foot footprint of a two-story residential with no exposures, low hazard. Again, gallon per minute flow rates of around 300 to 400 GPM, average staffing levels of around 14 to 15. But again, how does that relate back to the 20,000 square foot on up building? So there are disconnects when we talk about everything that relates back to some of our standards, but we are connecting some dots when we talk about some of the insights that we are gaining out of the data points from the from the research and the studies that's coming out of UL and NIST. So little by little, we're connecting a lot of dots, and this is a very fluid process to identify the best practices and also identify highly suggested practices, methodologies, and tactical approaches that have logic behind them, and that's part of everything that we have talked about here. So let me give you this. So how do we categorize all of these buildings? Giving you some considerations based upon siting issues, of which there are significant subsets in each one of those categories. We've talked about reading the fire ground, reading the building, reading the compartment, and reading the company as another critical tool as part of our FACTS modeling, FACTS, as well as our adaptive fire ground management modeling for mega mansions and large area residentials. So now let's talk about how do we classify these terms that some of you continue to hear, but nobody is fine-tuning what they really should mean. And again, we have been promoting these terminologies and concepts for going on 10 years now, and we continue to promote that, but again, it's been a struggle. So here's where we go from that. The typical single-family residential, and we'll utilize 2018, 2019. The average, again, is around between 28 to 29, actually as low as 27 up to around 2,900 square feet. That's the typical residential within that time frame. The common ranges of that single family are between 4 to 6,000 square feet. That's the common range of the typical residentials across the United States. The upper range is between 7,000 and 9,000 square feet. The McMansion, as it was defined back in the 80s, related back to around 3,000 square feet. What we utilize the McMansion term is for the cheaper, lower end, larger square foot, large area residential square foot that are between 4 and 8,000 square feet. So again, the McMansions between 4 to 8,000 square feet, less quality, both aesthetically, a higher degree of things that really aren't what they are. They're a lot more non-functional than functional considerations and attributes. All goes back to compromise and collapse considerations, fire dynamics, methods and materials of construction, performance-related issues. The large area residentials typically are going to be, in terms of our terminology, between 6 and 10,000 square feet. So if the McMansion is between 4 and 8, we move into the large area residentials, the LAR, in terms of the terminology and the acronym, between 6 and 10,000 square feet. Now when we talk about McMansions, here's where things start changing. The term mansion, derived out of the federal estate taxation code, traditionally has meant a building of quality construction, typically within the square footages of 11 and 25,000 square feet. So you can start seeing this correlating. So federal tax code identifies mansions as being between 11 and 25,000 square feet. So we've talked about large area residentials. We've classified them in terms of their square footages. The McMansions, if we continue to use that term, is between 4 and 8,000 square feet. The mega mansion, so if a mansion is between 11 and 25, the mega mansions are between 25 and 50,000 square feet. That is our basis of identifying, categorizing a mega mansion, of which there are bulletized subsets and categories of, again, building performance, construction features, programmatic spaces, gallon per minute flow rates, tactical windows, tasks, and operations. So the mega mansions, 25 to 50,000. Giga mansions, 50,000 to 75,000. And yes, we have tetra mansions between 75 and 100,000 square feet. So this gives us our commonality. If I can classify and I can correlate the features of construction, operation, tactics, and safety. So if I talk about our concept that we've made reference to in a number of programs dealing with our building facts model, first arriving, construction, tactics, and safety, that acronym. If we relate that back to construction, safety, and operations, we have a siting consideration. We have a classification situation that we can classify. We can also now derive all of the other appropriate operational issues dealing with operations. So that moves into a whole variety of tactical considerations for our building. So really the whole emphasis of our program was to lead us up to this particular junction point, understanding briefly some of the challenges, mission critical considerations, some of the aspects of our building, some considerations of our modeling factors and so forth. Some of the things, if you go on our Facebook page, we've got a couple of diagrams that are up on our Buildings on Fire on Facebook that, again, are some of our visuals that support our program. There's actually a slide that makes reference to the terminologies that we just gave you along with those square footages. Tactical modeling, and I'll just, before we move into the conclusion of our program here, the other considerations here when we talk about part of our size up and tactical adaptive modeling also deals with areas of origin. So when we consider the building's physical placement on site, on property, its categorization and classifications and those things that come out of how it's situated, what type of setting do we have, again, from seaside to mountainside, we relate that back to its classification and the aspects of size, volume, construction characteristics, and so forth. The other things that end up driving the fire ground modeling considerations include fire origin considerations, and they become even more important in terms of assessment and size up, and again, either postulating or predicting or actually knowing based upon what we are reading, informational, building intel, and so forth. Do we have fire originates that begins from compartment to structure, from compartment to structure, structure to compartment, external to compartment, external to structure. These all have very explicit strategic and tactical considerations. We take a look at, again, both large area residential, and this is even inclusive of our commercial firefighting modeling, and this is something that we've always stressed. Do we have a fire in the structure, or do we have a fire within the compartment? And again, there's a breakdown, a series of bullets here that when we start referring to those particular elements, they all relate back to, again, the building's anatomy, the era and vintage of construction, the occupancy type and occupancy risks. Goes back to identifying, based upon knowledge that we gain, of compromise or collapse considerations. It goes back to the methods and materials of construction that relate back to era and vintage. And then lastly, the fifth element of that is the fire dynamics. Again, having pre-identified, having skill set knowledge, learnings that, coupled with experience, give us some insights on how to put all this together that highly suggests, highly influences our decision-making process. So let me expand a moment here when we talk about this tactical modeling. So is the fire within the structure or is it in the compartment? It's a distinctive difference that to the whole global nature of considerations of firefighting operations. Do I have compartment to structure? Do I have structure to compartment? Do I have compartment to compartment? Compartment to external? Compartment to external to structure? External to compartment? External to structure, external fire to compartment to structure, and then lastly, compartment to compartment to structure. And I know that's a lot to be sort of put out there, but think about that, because the manner in which the fire originates and propagates and how it affects the potential compromise or susceptibility of components, systems, materials within the building highly influences building performance and highly influences decision-making, tactical operations, and tactical windows. It's just a series of connecting these dots in a very concise manner. I'll say this, that when we talk about large area residentials, it's critical to have building intel, building literacy, which gets into the whole building construction area. The 360 plus recon becomes very, very important, but sometimes becomes subjective to limitations based upon terrain and configurations. Sometimes, again, you may need a snowmobile or an ATV to be able to perform the 360 based upon configuration layout. You may be 15 minutes into trying to do a walk around of that building, but again, technology, information, accessibility to building intel and data, GIS, the various types of cloud-based information, you may very well be able to bring up the building's profile online, on your tablet, on your smartphones. I mean, it gets into a whole variety of different elements in terms of building intel. But again, we talk about deployment adequacies, getting out of harm's way, interrupting forward propagation of that fire. And the only way to do that is with some type of water resource. The quicker you can get water to interrupt that forward propagation, maybe not be able to put it out, but to stop that forward progress, utilize your water wisely in these particular types of structures. Monitor structural stability and have a clear understanding and sensitivity toward the connectivity of voids. And again, the mobility issues, monitoring the time element. What will kill you is, again, having a degree of inappropriate condition tactical reflex, just utilizing the wrong tactics for the building size, volume, and type, misunderstanding fire behavior, not having an appreciation for compromising collapse, not having the effective error management, have a clear respect for entrapment, don't allow complacency creep to come in, time compression, subpar human performance. Again, it goes back to knowledge, skills, and abilities. Understand the risk, and by all means, get rid of the bravado syndrome that falls back into that aspect. There are significant lessons and learnings. Sometimes everything is all new in these types of buildings. There is no history. Things are not on our radar screens, but certainly there's a lot to be learned. We talk about the local level conditions, understanding vintage, era, history, getting out, looking at your buildings, understanding the aspects of code, the characteristics, configuration, the quality of construction, the methods, and the materials. Again, things that can be studied and learned. Couple all of that with experience, and again, there is no magic app that's going to put all of this together. It's just a lot of work, study, and effort that just doesn't happen overnight. It does take quite a bit of effort to put all of these particular elements together. And again, I cannot stress enough about the operational limiting factors when we talk about time related to tactical priorities and the tasks, the ability, sometimes the limiting conditions, the ability to rescue civilians that are either in distress or trapped, fire control issues, fire mitigation, a false sense of fire severity, risk, and intervention, and treating our large area residentials or our mega mansions like a conventional residential fire. So, again, a lot of ground covered here in our two-part episodes, on our first part and our second part here. And again, lastly, I'll just conclude with a couple of additional significant required reading that's out there. We've talked about a couple of these earlier on, and we'll just finish off by talking about, again, the Green Bay, Wisconsin line of duty death of Lieutenant Arnie Wolf. That occurred on August the 13th of 2006. Again, a structural floor collapse in a 1976 vintage residential structure with engineered structural floor systems, NIOSH report F2006-26. And then also, again, there is the Green Bay Fire Department Edgewood Analysis Team Incident Final Report. So again, another opportunity to look at not only the NIOSH report, but the departmental report. One of the last things I'll make reference to, and this is what it's all about, guys, is that when we talk about the public. Some of you may recall back to January 2015 of a significant event that occurred in Maryland, Anne Arundel County in particular, and this was the Charles Point Road fire. This fire resulted, it occurred on January 19th, a couple of weeks after the holidays in December, January 19th, 2015, resulted in 6 fatalities, 2 adults and 4 grandchildren, in a fire in a 16,000 square foot plus single family residential that occurred in Anne Arundel County. The report that came out as a result of a combined effort of Anne Arundel County Fire Department and the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosive, ATF, really provided a significant high-level insight on the complex dynamics of how fire originates, propagates, and ends up affecting the lives of our civilians. No matter what we try to do, these large area residentials and mega mansions on up will truly challenge our ability to save lives. Very much will influence, not to say that we can't, but it will highly influence what we do in terms of civilian risk. Protected properties with sprinklers will certainly reduce those risks significantly, but I would encourage you, as we've gone through talking about these other reports, I would really encourage you to download that report, take a look at the aspects of what occurred with a Christmas tree that in the post-holiday time frame was maintained, but still was susceptible to the risks of a fire originating and resulting in the entrapment of 4 grandchildren, 4 young children, and that ranged in age from 6 to 9, and the 2 adults in that residence. But a very well-written and extensive report that, just as we talked about the near misses and the firefighter fatalities, should be on your radar screen. One of the things that we have put together, and for those of you that may be interested in it, we probably will, as I mentioned earlier, we probably will put together a webinar, a couple-hour webinar program where we can go through some slides and talk about this in a more engaging type of exchange here online later this month, in the month of April or the beginning of May. But we have done some original research in our large area residentials from 2002 through 2020. And we've identified a number of these reports and put together that information in a matrix context that talks about the numbers of line of duty deaths, their locations, the type of structures, and the years in which they were built, square footages, the types of tactics, the types of conditions, the adverse events, the average age of the buildings, and the correlation of what some of the leading insights gave us. And without getting into too much details, I'll just provide you with some key items. So when we talk about large area residentials, and again, we're going from greater than 3,000 square feet plus, we'll just talk about some of the contributors. One of the main contributors when we talk about adverse events, floor systems in 50% of those cases resulted in a floor system collapse relative to building performance. When we talk about structural systems, first and foremost, we had compromising or collapsing conditions dealing with engineered structural systems, predominantly within 42%, with the other 33% being those construction. So it's not always engineered wood systems. However, when we take a look at engineered wood systems, the majority of those system failures occurred within the floor system. The conventional construction systems ended up failing as a result of fire behavior or wind-driven conditions. The contributors toward line-of-duty deaths, 44% related back to floor conditions, 18% dealing with fire behavior and wind-driven conditions. And I'm just trying to see if I've got some other insights. I guess that's really about it that we'll get into the discussion. So there are things that we can identify that we'll explore a little bit further in one of our other episodes going forward. But again, for those of you that have some interest, keep an eye out for our webinar. We'll talk about those a little bit more in detail. For those of you that are going to FDIC in August, we'll talk about, we're doing a program, a 4-hour workshop on a fire officer's guide to building construction, dealing with operations and insights, of which we will have a small segment allocated toward mega mansions and large residentials, about an hour out of that time frame, maybe about 20 to 25% allocated to continuing challenges as we talked about here. So we've gone for 2 hours. We've got a two-hour segment. We had part one for the first hour. We completed part two here. And as you can tell, we're just scratching the surface. So for those of you that have an interest, get a hold of me. We'll get you some more information. Keep an eye out for our other upcoming programs here on fireengineering.com blog talk radio. We're really striving to try to get some more information out in a written context, both within the online version of fireengineering.com as well as in the magazine. We're just trying to work through all of the other challenges, still coming out of the challenges of our pandemic here, but we are hoping to get some of that reference and information. We also have a couple of things that we're working with the online staff at Fire Engineering to bring forward some additional opportunities for some learnings without really spilling the beans on it, but just keep looking for some items here. We're trying to pull the concepts together to make that into a working element without going too far in detail. For those of you that have listened live, again, I certainly appreciate your considerations here. Thank you very much for tuning in live. Really wish some of you would have called in, but that goes without saying. If you're listening to our program as part of a download, again, I thank you for taking time out of your schedule and whatever you're doing to listen in and increase your knowledge, skills, and abilities and your basis, and hopefully drive your level of curiosity or to drive your degree of self-improvement to make yourself better as a firefighter, as a company officer, and certainly as a commanding officer to improve your abilities on the fire ground. These buildings will kill us. There is no question about that. They continue to impact survivability and viability of civilians, and it is a different breed of structures. It has a entirely different context of rules of engagement. But again, we have the ability, if given the appropriate tools, to understand, to comprehend, to implement, and identify and implement an adaptive fire ground management approach with some of the concepts and insights that we've provided you here in our program. We can certainly move forward in a manner that makes the job more efficient and just allows us to do what's necessary to help the civilians that we are sworn to protect. And that's all part of our whole aspect of what's mission critical. It's being able to continue to strive to do what's necessary, the occupancy loads, the occupancy risks, and to get out there and do the stuff in the streets that the public expects us to do. So, again, thank you for tuning in to this edition of Buildings on Fire, taking it to your streets. Again, my thanks. Chris Naum is signing off. Until next time, on your street, in your city, around the country, and around the world, this is Buildings on Fire, taking the streets. Stay safe, everyone. See you next time.